blind, have low vision, or have another print disability which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Dasha, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 3rd, issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Looking at articles and opinions in the first section, federal independence, protected for now with Cook ruling by Nick Timiraos. The Supreme Court provided the most meaningful check to date on President Trump's effort to fire Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook when it said she could remain in her job until it takes up her case in January. The Trump administration had asked the court to remove Cook before lower courts resolved her lawsuit fighting Trump's dismissal attempt. The court granted similar requests the administration made for other agency commissioners Trump fired. As a result, the development could become an inflection point in Trump's effort to reshape the central bank, particularly after financial markets and Congress provided little pushback to the first ever effort to fire a sitting Fed official. Trump has been highly critical of the Fed this year for not slashing short-term interest rates. Central bank independence, or the freedom to take unpopular steps in the economy's long-run interest, emerged from the lessons of the 70s when political pressure on the Fed contributed to runaway inflation. That autonomy has no explicit constitutional protection and rests instead on narrow and tenuous legal foundations. While presidents have often complained about Fed policy, three institutional forces, markets, the Senate, and the courts, have historically deterred more heavy-handed intervention. Trump announced in August he would attempt to remove Cook, who has consistently voted with Fed Chair Jerome Powell. President Joe Biden appointed her in 2022, and she began a new 14-year term last year. Until this summer, no president had attempted to remove a Fed official since the central bank's founding in 1913. Financial markets barely flinched over Cook's attempted firing, in contrast to how Trump's threats in April and July to possibly sack Powell unsettled investors. Given both the extreme nature of the scenario, a president gaining firmer control over Fed appointments, and the legal uncertainty, the market maybe is not quite sure how to play this, said Derek Tang, a policy analyst at the research firm L.H. Meyer. Several GOP lawmakers on the Senate Banking Committee, which oversees the Fed, have been notably deferential in their public comments on Trump's bid to dismiss Cook. U.S. District Judge Gia Cobb ruled in September that Cook was substantially likely to succeed with a claim that her firing was unlawful and temporarily blocked her removal. A 2-1 federal appeals court decision upheld that ruling. The Supreme Court's decision defers until next year a final answer on whether Cook can remain in her job while her legal challenge plays out. It builds on an unsigned order the court issued this past May that suggested the Fed could enjoy special legal protections that other regulatory bodies don't have. That court ruling allowed Trump to remove other independent agency commissioners, but carved out the Fed, calling it a, quote, uniquely structured quasi-private entity, end quote, with special historical protections, essentially warning Trump that Fed officials might enjoy strong job removal protections. In another article in U.S. News, presidents' appeals rack the judiciary. As cases flood in, justices issue orders without explanation, puzzling lower courts, by Lydia Wheeler. The Trump administration's extraordinary pace of emergency appeals to the Supreme Court is straining the judiciary. 8 months into President Trump's second term, the administration has sought emergency intervention 28 times with the Supreme Court after losing preliminary decisions in the lower courts. That is more than the administrations of Joe Biden, Barack Obama, and George W. Bush combined, said Stephen Vladeck, a Georgetown law professor who tracks the issue. The pace also puts the White House well on the way to eclipsing the 41 emergency appeals the Trump administration filed in its first term. Under normal procedures, the court considers about 70 cases a year, with each taking months of deliberation. And only a handful of those cases are typically of blockbuster quality. The flood of emergency appeals has turned that process upside down. It is unprecedented as a matter of the nationwide significance of the questions that are being rushed to the court, Vladek said. And it is provoking an unprecedented degree of discord between the justices and their colleagues on the lower federal courts. In 1 week alone last month, the Trump administration filed 3 emergency requests: to terminate temporary legal protections for Venezuelans living in the U.S., to keep transgender and non-binary people from picking their preferred sex on their passports, and to seek the unprecedented removal of a member of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors. Trump's eagerness to push the bounds of presidential power has created a new pattern. The White House takes aggressive action and gets sued right away. Lower courts put a Trump initiative on hold for now, and the administration then quickly asked the Supreme Court to lift the hold. The High Court, in those cases, isn't issuing final rulings, but its orders effectively decide whether Trump's efforts can move forward for many months, if not longer. And those answers have broad ramifications for Trump's agenda and the litigants affected by it. Justices across the ideological spectrum have lamented the skyrocketing growth of their emergency docket, which is sometimes referred to as the shadow docket, because the court considers emergency appeals with minimal briefing and often without oral arguments. And because of that truncated process, the court typically issues its emergency orders with little or no explanation behind them. When the court last week allowed Trump to withhold $4 billion in foreign aid funding, Justice Elena Kagan said in dissent that the court, per usual, had to consider the Trump administration's request on a short fuse with scant briefing, no oral argument, and no opportunity to deliberate in conference. In a public appearance last year, Justice Brett Kavanaugh said the emergency appeals are challenging for a court that doesn't like making snap decisions. The court has given Trump much of what he's asked for so far, but the brevity of its orders has flummoxed judges who say there's no way to interpret them. "Oh, we can only guess as to the court's rationale when it provides none," a 3-judge panel in San Francisco said last month in rejecting the administration's request to immediately strip temporary protections from thousands of Venezuelans living in the U.S. "I'm not criticizing the justices. I'm just saying they're using a vehicle that's there, but they're telling us nothing," Judge James Wynn said during a recent appeals court hearing in Virginia to review a trial court injunction that blocked the Department of Government Efficiency from accessing sensitive Social Security data. A pair of conservative justices in August said the Supreme Court was sending cues which lower courts were ignoring. The rebuke by Justices Neil Gorsuch and Kavanaugh came in a case in which the court let the Trump administration withhold millions of dollars in health research grants after lower courts had blocked the move. Whatever their own views, judges are duty-bound to respect the hierarchy of the federal court system, Gorsuch wrote. U.S. District Judge Allison Burroughs in Massachusetts fired back at Gorsuch a couple of weeks later when she ruled the administration's cuts to Harvard's research funding were unconstitutional. In a footnote, Burroughs said it was unhelpful and unnecessary to criticize judges for defying the Supreme Court when they are working to find the right answer in a rapidly evolving doctrinal landscape where they must grapple with both existing precedent and interim guidance from the Supreme Court that appears to set that precedent aside without much explanation or consensus. In one of the biggest emergency cases, the Supreme Court on Wednesday indicated that it wanted to slow down. Trump had asked the court to allow him to remove Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook from office while she challenges her dismissal. Rather than make that decision now, the court said it would wait and hear arguments in January. Looking at the opinion pages, review and outlook, Europe's new war on the Jews. a suspected terrorist, killed two people at a synagogue in Manchester, England on Thursday. Most troubling is that for all the expressions of shock from politicians, no one really seems all that surprised. Manchester police say the attacker is 35-year-old Jihad Ali Al-Shami, a British citizen of Syrian descent. Worshippers were gathered to observe Yom Kippur, the most important holy day in the Jewish year, and the attack appears to have involved ramming people with a car and then stabbings. It may take time for investigators to pin down a precise motive, but it doesn't take imagination to venture some guesses given the target and the timing. A high holy day only days before the second anniversary of Hamas's October 7th, 2023 invasion of Israel. The past few years have seen an uptick in violent anti-Semitism across Europe. Sometimes the hatred is inspired by Islamism. Sometimes it's the political far left's anti-Semitic version of anti-Zionism. Often, the two motivations converge, and sometimes it's directly linked to foreign terrorism. German authorities this week arrested three men, two Germans and a Lebanese citizen, all apparently of Muslim background, on charges of membership in Hamas and planning a terror attack against Israeli or Jewish institutions in Germany. Credit Britain's political class for uniformly condemning the Manchester attack and decrying violence against Jews on their shores, and for mostly avoiding rhetorical nods to the putative evils of Islamophobia in the same breath. Still, you wonder what country these folks have been living in. The area is a very large Jewish community next to a very large Muslim community, and by and large, community relations are excellent between all different ethnic groups and religious groups, local Labour Member of Parliament Graham Stringer said after the synagogue attack. Others issued similar encomiums to British multiculturalism. It's hard to take such people seriously. One and only one religious group in Britain now routinely worships under the protection of security guards and must run its own security service. The first 6 months of 2025 witnessed 1,521 anti-Semitic incidents, according to the protection organization, the Community Security Trust, CST. That's the second highest tally for the January to June period, behind only the 2019 incidents in early 2024. The CST links the escalation to the conflict in the Middle East, and the implication is clear. Plenty of people in Britain are happy to blame Jews in general for a war far away involving a foreign government. In theory, one can oppose Zionism without being anti-Semitic, but that's not what's happening in Europe these days. Anti-Zionism since October 7th is providing new cover for anti-Semitism that has been bubbling in Europe for a long time. Assaults and harassment against Jews are becoming frequent in France, the Netherlands, Germany, Britain, and elsewhere. Politicians invariably decry such acts and then cower before sympathizers of the perpetrators for domestic political purposes. Witness French President Emmanuel Macron and British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, among others, rewarding terrorism by recognizing a Palestinian state. It's trendy on the left to talk about globalizing the Intifada. European Jews can grimly attest that this is happening. The war on Jews has gone global, is in danger of becoming much worse, and Europe is on the front lines. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Another piece, editorial, in the Review and Outlook section. Can New Jersey get a tax break? There is that article I'm not going to read right now. If you want to hear it, you can call the radio station and someone will read it to you. And then we have Volkswagen gets what it paid for. I'll read that one. All right. As if tariffs and inflation aren't enough, Volkswagen may face a strike at its largest U.S. plant. A work stoppage can't be what the company envisioned last year when it welcomed a campaign to unionize the plant. And the standoff is a lesson for other car makers. The United Auto Workers, UAW, announced last weekend that support for a strike is overwhelming among its members at VW's plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, based on pledge cards workers filled out before a formal vote can be called. The strike threat emerged after a year of contract talks without an agreement, though VW says it's moved a long way toward a deal. The company's best and final offer would raise wages 20% over 4 years, along with one-time bonuses of up to $5,500 and another 8% annual bonus for good attendance. It also includes an annual cost of living adjustment of up to 45 cents an hour. The union wants a 24% raise to bring wages in line with those of the big three automakers, as well as bigger corporate contributions to health and retirement plans. The strike threat means VW is likely to pay either in lost output or a richer-than-expected contract. A one-week stoppage could cost millions of dollars in unshipped units, and the costs compound the longer it lasts. But accepting the UAW's terms would boost permanent costs and erase much of the margin that makes the plant competitive. That could eliminate jobs in the long run. VW's dilemma is the result of the UAW's successful campaign to organize the plant in April 2024, after workers had rejected the union in 2014 and 2019. The biggest difference last year was the lack of company opposition. VW declined to advise employees of the union's long-term costs, and 73% of workers welcomed the UAW. Company culture is one part of the story. The German automaker is used to working with unions back home, which take part in its governance and are usually less combative than their American peers. But politics may also have pushed VW to roll over. 33 Senate Democrats wrote a letter in January 2024 to every non-union automaker in the U.S., suggesting the companies would lose electric vehicle subsidies if they opposed union campaigns. VW, which builds an electric SUV in Chattanooga, may have decided that fighting the union would be the costlier move. Now the EV subsidies are going away in any case, thanks to the GOP budget bill and the Trump administration orders. Democrats hoped their threat would help the UAW win more plants in the South, where many foreign automakers and startups have set up to take advantage of right-to-work laws. Yet, Mercedes workers at a plant near Tuscaloosa, Alabama, snubbed the union last year, as did Hyundai workers in Montgomery. Both companies campaigned against the union, and employees sided with the companies. Democrats lost the power to steer companies toward unions when Republicans claimed the White House and Senate, which may simplify the question for non-union automakers. The decision is in workers' hands, but company engagement makes a difference. In the Potomac Watch column by Kimberly A. Strassel, the GOP's Obamacare crossroads. When the smog clears from this first government shutdown in 7 years, there will be ownership. Either a chastened Democratic Party will own the embarrassment of a foolhardy closure, or an outfoxed Republican Party will own the 15-year-old unreformed calamity known as Obamacare. Vice President J.D. Vance began well enough on Monday characterizing Democrats' demands to keep government running as preposterous and ridiculous. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer wants $450 billion to make permanent enhanced Obamacare subsidies for higher-income Americans, which were temporarily enacted during the COVID pandemic. This should be ludicrous to Republicans who have already passed a bill to keep government open and who were elected to fix a struggling healthcare system. The vice president lambasted Democrats for breaking the healthcare system in the first place, only to hold government hostage until we get everything we want. That sounded good, although it didn't capture an alternate GOP calculation going on behind the scenes. Could we be accused of being meanies if those handouts lapse? Might an Obamacare bailout ease our path to re-election next year? And what better excuse for spending that money than to cite the shutdown as a good cause to hear out Democrats? Before 24 hours had elapsed, Mr. Vance was back at the podium, offering Democrats a shutdown off-ramp via a simple reversal of order. First vote to reopen the government, then we'll give you everything we want. It was a hard-won Republican ignorance that landed the country with Obamacare in the first place. The GOP didn't want to know or talk about rising healthcare prices, couldn't be bothered to learn about the problem. Barack Obama was happy to fill the gap. After the passage of the Affordable Care Act of 2010, healthcare reformers like Senator Tom Coburn and Georgia Representative Tom Price, both physicians, rallied the GOP to offer pro-market alternatives, and the party nearly succeeded in repealing the mandate subsidy mess in 2017. That failure instead spurred a return to the dark ages, and the lack of interest is now herding Republicans toward further expanding and perpetuating the fiasco. Knowledge and courage would require Republicans to explain to the public that most of the Obamacare premium increases that are coming in 2026 are a result not of those expiring bump-ups, but because Obamacare overall is failing. The government mandates and insurance subsidies have created a toxic stew of industry consolidation, inflated payments, opacity about those payments, constrained choices, and the steady erosion of better employee-provided coverage. Continuing to shovel money into temporary COVID-era bonuses to avoid a cliff isn't even the equivalent of putting a Band-Aid on a femoral artery bleed. It's making the cut bigger. One glimmer of possibility. Some Republicans are making the case that getting nothing in return for giving everything is, to use the words of Donald Trump, not so smart. The GOP senators working on an extension compromise with Democrats had vaguely suggested that there might be some minor price to extending the enhanced handouts, say income caps or minimum amounts participants must pay for premiums or fraud prevention. But that's doing little more than making COVID-era expansion of Obamacare a little less bad. Republican health reformers, those who still exist, are instead making the case that Democrats should have to give far more. If what's driving ever-increasing prices is the structure of Obamacare itself, the trade for more subsidies needs to be structural reforms to the underlying program. Making the rounds is a recent op-ed by health guru Avik Roy, who proposes pairing any extension of enhanced subsidies with permanent reform of Obamacare's more costly insurance regulations. For instance, rules that land younger Americans with outsized costs. Some senators have been bringing in healthcare gurus to give briefings on other ideas, and there are many: essential benefits, the medical loss ratio, etc. There are plenty of problems Democrats could be expected to own and to fix as a trade for more dollars. It has also belatedly occurred to the Senate GOP that it doesn't exist in a vacuum. Speaker Mike Johnson did yeoman's work getting his slim majority to pass a bill to keep the government open, but a sizable portion of the House Republican caucus will flatly reject a straight-up extension of enhanced premiums, whether such a proposal comes as part of a later appropriations or in a standalone bill. Do Senate Republicans intend to sandbag him with an agreement that he can pass only with Democratic support, a move that might cost him his job? Or is there a deep enough reform to be made to bring conservatives along? This is more than just another stop on the rolling congressional circus. It's a crossroads. Republicans need to decide if they're a party that buys votes by expanding government entitlements, junior varsity competitors against the Democratic spending jocks. Just as important, they need to decide to begin the serious project of reforming Obamacare or give in and take possession of it. The moment for that decision looks to be now. Another opinion piece is by David A. Relman and Paul A. Fredericks. Dr. Relman is a professor of medicine and microbiology at Stanford University. He chaired the NAS study and co-chaired the experts panel on anomalous health incidents. Dr. Friedrichs is a retired Air Force Major General. He served as Joint Staff Surgeon 2019-23 and Director of the Office of Pandemic Preparedness and Response 2023-25. Take Havana Syndrome seriously. Early in their training, medical students learn the importance of listening to patients, developing possible diagnoses, and undertaking a science-based investigation to find the most likely explanation for any ailment. Similarly, scientists learn how to identify and address problems by forming hypotheses and using carefully designed experiments to test them. For many problems, we often don't have a simple answer right away. No condition more starkly illustrates how challenging it can be to help those with complex medical issues than the anomalous health incidents known as Havana Syndrome. In 2016, U.S. personnel assigned to the American Embassy in Cuba began to report unusual and debilitating symptoms. In some cases, what they were experiencing couldn't be explained by medical or environmental conditions. Hundreds of Americans serving in other parts of the world also described similar symptoms, including the sudden onset of intense sound, pressure, and pain in the head, often accompanied by loss of balance and cognitive difficulties. Persistent brain fog and dizziness have destroyed some sufferers' abilities to work and perform daily activities. Unfortunately, some of the affected have been smeared by colleagues as malingerers or worse. We are physicians that have served our country in various roles, including recently in policy positions at the White House. We are troubled by how these Americans have been treated, both by their doctors and by some in the media. It isn't the first time patients with puzzling medical conditions have been ignored or dismissed. It took decades to be able to identify and help veterans suffering from Gulf War illness. Physicians must commit to sustained and comprehensive care for the suffering. The government must figure out what's causing this. The intelligence community has concluded that most and perhaps all cases can be explained by known conditions. The official U.S. position is that no worldwide actor is responsible. Yet both the National Academy of Science and an external panel of experts have determined that some cases could be attributed to exposure to pulsed radio frequency energy. The expert panel noted that directed energy could be produced by concealable devices. From a military and medical perspective, it would be unwise to dismiss the evidence for directed energy, and it is morally wrong to dismiss the symptoms and suffering of those who have experienced Havana syndrome. The doctors caring for these patients need an updated, standardized clinical protocol. Congress should direct the Defense Department and other relevant agencies to update standardized clinical protocols, which are used by all medical professionals caring for those patients. Lawmakers should also provide sustained funding for clinical and scientific research to understand how Havana syndrome works and how to cure it. Some good research has already begun. We owe at least this much to the brave men and women who, while serving our nation, suffered real and sometimes devastating injuries. Most important, we believe them. Now looking at the World Watch column in World News. In Syria, an assembly election is set for Sunday. Syria is set to hold parliamentary elections on Sunday for the first time since longtime autocrat Bashar al-Assad was unseated in a rebel offensive in December. Under the 50-year rule of the Assad dynasty, Syria held elections in which all citizens could vote, but they were widely regarded as shams. Sunday's election won't be a fully democratic process either. Rather, most seats will be voted on by electoral colleges in each district, while one-third will be appointed by interim president Ahmad al-Sharaa. But the results will likely be taken as a barometer of how serious interim authorities are about inclusivity. In Morocco, a leader offers talks after protesters die. Morocco's government said Thursday it would address grievances fueling youth-led protests a day after security forces killed three people during unrest. Speaking before a council of government ministers, Prime Minister Aziz Ahanouch didn't detail reforms under discussion, but said he was ready for dialogue and debate within institutions and public spaces. Authorities updated this week's death toll to three on Thursday. The Interior Ministry said 354 people, mostly law enforcement, had suffered injuries. It said hundreds of cars were damaged, as well as banks, shops, and public buildings in 23 provinces. In Turkey, a moderate quake rattles Istanbul. A moderately strong earthquake, preliminary 5 magnitude, shook Istanbul and other parts of northwestern Turkey around 2:55 p.m. local time on Thursday, Turkey's emergency services said. The quake sent people running from buildings and led to school evacuations, but there were no reports of damage or casualties. In Istanbul, a city of 16 million, the risk of a serious earthquake is a genuine concern. Turkey sits on top of major fault lines and quakes are frequent. In 2023, a magnitude 7.8 earthquake killed more than 53,000 people in the country's southern and southeastern provinces. In France, protesters march against austerity. Protesters took to the streets of more than 200 towns and cities Thursday to denounce spending cuts and demand higher taxes on the rich. They included thousands of workers, retirees, and students in Paris, where the Eiffel Tower was closed as workers went on strike. The nationwide strikes, called by France's major unions, are the latest of a series of protests that started last month. Unions are urging Prime Minister Sébastien Lecornu, appointed last month, to abandon draft budget measures proposed by his predecessor, which include social welfare freezes and austerity measures. And in Sudan, the UN tallies deaths in a besieged city. At least 91 civilians were killed in Sudan's besieged city of El Fasher in attacks by the paramilitary force Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, within 10 days last month, the United Nations said Thursday. The war between the RSF and the military began in 2023, when tensions erupted between the two previous allies that were meant to oversee a democratic transition after a 2019 uprising. The fighting has killed at least 40,000 people, according to the World Health Organization, and displaced as many as 12 million others. El Fasher is the military's last stronghold in the sprawling Darfur region. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Looking at the business and finance section, in Heard on the Street, Financial Analysis and Commentary, Pfizer's Trump deal lifts Big Pharma. The company's accord with the president clears a cloud over the whole sector. Big Pharma has been out of favor with investors on fears of tariffs and price controls. This week might have marked a turning point. On Tuesday, Pfizer chief executive Albert Bourla stood alongside President Trump at the White House to unveil Trump RX, a government website that will allow Americans to buy certain medicines at discounted cash prices. According to Pfizer, the price cuts on its products will average around 50% and in some cases reach as high as 85%. The company also committed to price all new medicines at parity with other developed markets, while extending most favored nation pricing to Medicaid patients. Bourla paired the announcement with a $70 billion pledge to expand U.S. drug manufacturing and research and development. In return, the company gains a three-year grace period to exempt it from national security-related tariffs. Plenty of questions remain. For one, it isn't obvious how useful Trump RX will be for most Americans who already receive coverage through private insurance, Medicare, or Medicaid. And details are lacking on how Pfizer will price future drug releases, both overseas and in the U.S. But the big picture is that Trump's pressure campaign on the pharma industry might be winding down, since most big pharma companies are already pledging large investments in U.S. manufacturing. They should now be able to steer clear of heavy tariffs. For products still being imported from European countries, a deal reached with the European Union in late July capping U.S. tariffs on pharma exports at 15% also helps. And now, the standoff over pricing is nearing resolution. The optics of the Pfizer announcement signal that Trump is eager to strike deals with the industry. If this is all that President Trump does on drug pricing, it is likely a win for the pharmaceutical industry and should serve as a clearing event, said Raymond James analyst Chris Meekins in a note. The NYSE Arca Pharmaceutical Index rallied on Tuesday and Wednesday, reflecting a sense that the political overhang might finally be lifting. Pfizer rose more than 10% over the two sessions. Even after recent gains, the ARCA Pharmaceutical Index is still down about 5% over the past 12 months, compared with an 18% rise for the S&P 500. The index trades at one of its widest historical discounts, fetching about 14 times forward earnings compared with the S&P's 500's 23. Some of that gap reflects the AI-driven surge in technology stocks, but much of it stems from investors steering clear of a sector overshadowed by politics. The setup is reminiscent of the early 1990s, when drug stocks were pummeled by fears of Hillary Care, the Clinton administration's proposed healthcare overhaul. When the plan collapsed in late 1994, the group snapped back sharply. Signs of a weakening U.S. economy could give investors another reason to return to healthcare. Historically, healthcare has tended to outperform during downturns because of its less discretionary nature. A more forgiving environment in Washington, combined with a slowing economy, could be just what the doctor ordered for pharma stocks. This is by David Wehner. Rivian narrows 2025 delivery guidance by Adriano Marchesi. Rivian Automotive narrowed its delivery target for the year and reported lower production on the third quarter than a year ago. The electric vehicle startup on Thursday narrowed its 2025 delivery guidance to a range of 41,500 to 43,500 vehicles. The previous target was for 40,000 to 46,000 vehicles. Production in the quarter from its manufacturing facility in Normal, Illinois, fell to 10,720 vehicles, while deliveries were 13,201 vehicles. A year ago, Rivian produced 13,157 vehicles, but delivered 10,018 vehicles. Recently, the EV maker, which currently makes two models, a pickup and an SUV, broke ground on a new assembly plant about 45 miles east of Atlanta, which is expected to be Rivian's second and set to begin production in 2028. The move comes as the rest of the U.S. auto industry is shifting away from EVs, as consumer interest wanes and recent policy changes support production of more gas-powered cars. BP's new chairman calls for more urgency and simplification push by Adam Whitaker. BP's new chairman backed the company's strategic direction, but said the business must act with urgency and signaled further asset sales as it attempts to shore up its balance sheet while boosting valuations for shareholders. In a message to staff on Wednesday, Albert Manifold said the oil major needs to carefully look at its portfolio and suggested further assets would be sold to simplify what he described as an overly complex business. Manifold said it was clear the change of direction is the right approach and that great progress has been made, but called for faster delivery as it battles lower profitability and high levels of debt. The British energy major is seeking to revive its fortunes after strategic missteps caused its share to lag behind rivals Shell, ExxonMobil, and Chevron. Meanwhile, activist hedge fund Elliott Investment and Management has taken a stake in the company with a view to pushing for significant changes. In August, BP said it would launch a new cost review and evaluate its portfolio to ensure it is maximizing shareholder value. This follows a strategic revamp and the jettisoning of its push into low-carbon energy, such as wind, solar, and electric vehicle charging, and refocused on fossil fuels earlier in the year. Manifold said the business will have to take tough decisions and that some of BP's assets might be more valuable to others. A representative for BP declined to comment. One division already flagged for disposal is its lubricants business, Castrol. The company targets $20 billion of asset sales by 2027 to reduce its net debt and has announced several sales already this year. Tesco boosts its earnings outlook despite grocery sector competition by Amy Look. Tesco raised its full-year profit expectations after reporting a rise in sales for the fiscal first half as the UK grocer seeks to fend off competitors amid a price war in the sector. The supermarket chain on Thursday increased guidance for adjusting operating profit, its preferred profit metric, which omits exceptional and other one-off items, expecting £2.9 billion to £3.1 billion, or $3.91 billion to $4.18 billion for the year to February 2026. It previously guided for adjusted operating profit of £2.7 billion to £3 billion. For the half year to August 23, the company reported an adjusted operating profit of £1.6 billion compared with £1.6 billion in the year earlier period. Tesco posted first half revenue of £36.4 billion compared with 37 $34.77 billion. Like-for-like sales rose 4.3%, edging up 4.9% in its home market. Pre-tax profit fell 6.3% to £1.31 billion, it said. Tesco also raised its dividend to 4.80 pence a share, up 12.9% from the same period the year before. A better-than-expected customer response to our actions and the benefits of an extended period of good weather have helped offset the cost of our investments, the company said. Analysts had expected adjusted operating profit at £1.5 billion on revenue of £35.76 billion, according to estimates compiled by Visible Alpha. Competition in the UK grocery sector has accelerated after Asda vowed to cut prices earlier this year, but recent industry data showed Tesco managed to defend its number one position by market share. It currently has 27.6% of the market, according to the World Panel by Numerator Data, followed by J. Sainsbury with 15%. Tesco's chief financial officer, Imran Nawaz, said on a call with investors that the grocer's price position today is stronger than in April, when the company gave its previous profit guidance. Recently, there's been an uptick in interest around fresh food and increased dining-in habits, Chief Executive Ken Murphy said on the call.
They're relatively positive trends for us, Murphy said. It's a source of big investment for us, both in our fresh offering and Tesco Finest.
Like-for-like food sales in the UK grew 5.7% in the half year as the company launched 470 new products. It said sales of the Finest range rose 16% on year. The grocer's London-listed shares rose 5.3% in Thursday's trading. Berkshire is to buy Occidental Arm for $9.7 billion by Connor Hart. Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway said it would buy Occidental Petroleum's petrochemical business for $9.7 billion in cash. The move confirms an earlier report from the Wall Street Journal about the deal, which is Berkshire's largest since 2022. This transaction strengthens our financial position and catalyzes a significant resource opportunity we've been building in our oil and gas business for the last decade, Occidental Chief Executive Vicky Hullub said Thursday. Occidental, which already counted Berkshire as its largest shareholder, is best known for its oil and gas operations. Its petrochemical division, OxyChem, manufactures and sells chemicals used in applications such as chlorinating water, recycling batteries, and producing paper. The unit generated nearly $5 billion in sales in the 12 months ended in June. The deal is expected to close in the fourth quarter, subject to regulatory approvals and other customary closing conditions. Occidental said it plans to use $6.5 billion of the transaction proceeds to pay down debt. BASF puts off environmental unit sale by Nina Keenly. BASF said it plans to keep its environmental catalyst and metal solutions business for longer. The German chemical giant on Thursday said it considers itself to be the best owner to operate the business, which in 2014 generated sales of 7 billion euros, equivalent to $8.21 billion. The business, which includes emission control catalysts for vehicles, is expected to generate cumulative cash flows of around €4 billion between 2024 and 2030. Last year, BASF said that in order to sharpen focus on its core operations, options for non-core businesses were being explored. BASF may now start earlier with the share buyback it had outlined last year, it said. BASF said it would repurchase shares for at least 4 billion euros between 2027 and 2028. In the battery materials division, fixed costs have been reduced, and agreements have been signed with key customers to fill existing capacities, BASF said. Collaboration opportunities along the value chain are being explored, it added. The company also approached the market to explore strategic options for the businesses making automotive original equipment manufacturer coatings, automotive refinish coatings, and surface treatments. A decision on the future of these businesses is expected in the fourth quarter, it said. Meanwhile, the company is preparing to list a minority stake of its agricultural division in a potential IPO in 2027. The company backed its 2028 targets. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Continuing business and finance, Tyson Krupp, EP Group Drop Steel Deal Talks by Nina Keenley. Tyson Krupp ended talks with EP Group on a possible 50-50 joint venture for Steel Europe, clearing the way for rival suitor Jindal Steel International. The German industrial conglomerate said Thursday that Czech industrial tycoon Daniel Kretinsky's EP Group has withdrawn from further talks. Tyson Krupp added that it would acquire the 20% of Steel Europe sold to EP Group for the purchase price it paid. The news follows a non-binding offer from India's Jindal Steel for Tyson Krupp's European steel operations in mid-September. Jindal put forth a plan to decarbonize the business and make its production of steel in Germany competitive, Tyson Krupp said at the time. Tyson Krupp has tried unsuccessfully a number of times to sell its steel business in an attempt to reduce complexity, boost competitiveness, and increase profitability. In July 2024, EP Group acquired a stake in the business with the agreement at the time providing for further talks on an additional 30% stake, aiming to create a 50-50 joint venture. EP Group didn't respond to a request for comment. Tyson Krupp said both companies mutually agreed to end talks. An AI pioneer sounds alarm on dangers. Benjo worries about AI's capacity to deceive users in pursuing own goals by Isabel Bosquet. A little over 2 years ago, AI pioneer Joshua Benjo was among the loudest voices calling for a moratorium on AI model development to focus on safety standards. No one paused. Instead, companies dumped hundreds of billions of dollars into building more advanced models that could execute long chains of reasoning and increasingly take autonomous action on behalf of users. And today, Benjo, considered one of the godfathers of AI, is as concerned as ever. Benjo is a professor at Université de Montréal and the founder and scientific advisor of MILA, an AI research institute for Quebec. Earlier this year, he also launched Law Zero, a nonprofit research organization aimed at exploring how to build AI models that are truly safe. Benjo sat down with the Wall Street Journal Leadership Institute to talk about the challenges of building safe AI, why today's race-style market conditions make it even harder, and how much time humanity has left before it may be too late. Edited excerpts from the conversation follow. Wall Street Journal. You've talked about AI lying to people and deceiving its users. Why does it do that? Benjo. Well, I don't think we have answer to all the scientific answers to that, but I can give you a few directions. One is the way that these systems have been trained is mostly to imitate people, and people will lie and deceive and will try to protect themselves in spite of the instructions you give them because they have some other goals. And the other reason is there's been a lot of advances in these reasoning models. They are getting good at strategizing. Wall Street Journal. Why would the goals of AI we create ever not align with our goals? Benjo. In order to achieve a goal, you're going to have sub-goals. The problem with those sub-goals in the context of AI is that it isn't something we check. We ask it to do something, and we don't have a say on how it does it. And the how sometimes doesn't match our expectations, and it can be bad. So the scenario in 2001 A Space Odyssey is exactly like this. Recent experiments show that in some circumstances where the AI has no choice but between its preservation, which means the goals that it was given, and doing something that causes the death of a human, they might choose the death of a human to preserve their goals. Wall Street Journal. Can we just tell the AI not to lie or deceive or harm us when we build it? Benjo, they already have all these safety instructions and moral instructions, but unfortunately, it's not working in a sufficiently reliable way. Recently, OpenAI said that with the current direction we have, the current framework for frontier models, we will not get rid of hallucinations. So, there's a sense in which the current way we're doing things is never going to deliver the kind of trustworthiness that public users and companies deploying AI demand. Wall Street Journal. Jumping from hallucinations and deception to potential human extinction feels like a big leap. How real of a threat is that? Benjo. If we build machines that are way smarter than us and have their own preservation goals, that's dangerous. It's like creating a competitor to humanity that is smarter than us, and they could influence people through persuasion, through threats, through manipulation of public opinion. There are all sorts of ways that they can get things to be done in the world through people, like, for example, helping a terrorist build a virus that could create new pandemics that could be very dangerous to us. The thing with catastrophic events like extinction, and even less radical events that are still catastrophic, like destroying our democracies, is that they're so bad that even if there was only a 1% chance it could happen, it is not acceptable. Wall Street Journal. All the big AI labs have been pretty outspoken about the safety and guardrails they're putting into these models. Do you have conversations with them? Benjo. I read their reports. And I have some conversations, but actually, the conversations that I have tell me that a lot of people inside these companies are worried. I also have the impression that being inside a company that is trying to push the frontier maybe gives rise to an optimistic bias. And that is why we need independent third parties to validate that whatever safety methodologies they're developing is really fine. Wall Street Journal. At Law Zero, you're developing tech solutions that will provide some oversight for agentic AI. What do you think are the biggest barriers to other AI companies doing more work there? Benjo. The race condition. The companies are competing almost like on a weekly basis for the next version that's going to be better than their competitors. And so they're focused on not looking like they're lagging in that race. Wall Street Journal. How much time do we have to solve this before we encounter these major risks? Benjo, if you listen to some of these leaders, it could be just a few years. I think 5 to 10 years is very plausible. But we should be feeling the urgency in case it's just 3 years. Wall Street Journal. We are hearing about how more and more companies inside and outside the tech industry are working to integrate AI into their workflows. What advice do you have for them? Benjo. Companies that are using AI should demand evidence that the AI system they're deploying or using are trustworthy. The same thing that governments should be demanding. But markets can drive companies to do the right thing if companies understand that there's a lot of unknown unknowns and potentially catastrophic risks. I think the citizens should also wake up and better understand what are the issues, what are the pros, what are the cons, and how do we navigate in between the potentially bad things so that we can benefit from AI? Conversation with Joshua Benjo, an AI pioneer at the Université de Montréal. ChatGPT maker's value soars. Let's see, this is... OpenAI has completed a deal with investors that values the ChatGPT maker at around $500 billion, according to people familiar with the matter, giving the startup a valuation on par with global corporate Goliaths just 3 years after it launched its flagship product. A group, including existing investors SoftBank and United Arab Emirates-based MGX, paid about $6.6 billion to buy shares owned by OpenAI employees, the people said, finalizing a deal that began taking shape this summer. The sale speaks to the frenzy around artificial intelligence and the sky-high expectations for OpenAI. It is also a rapid jump from earlier this year when SoftBank agreed to lead a $40 billion investment in the startup at a $300 billion valuation. OpenAI's latest valuation gives it a market value roughly equivalent to ExxonMobil, which reported annual revenue of almost $350 billion last year and profit of more than $30 billion. The AI company, meanwhile, is expecting $13 billion of revenue this year and a net loss in the billions of dollars, the Wall Street Journal has previously reported. While OpenAI has had explosive growth with consumers, it said in August it has 700 million weekly users, it has taken on unprecedented financial commitments that mean it will eventually need to bring in far more revenue to pay its bills. The company recently agreed to a deal with Oracle to purchase $300 billion in computing power over roughly 5 years, people familiar with the deal have said. OpenAI has also committed $10 billion to a chip-building plan with Broadcom, is planning to build its own hardware device, and is hoping to fund its own data centers, in addition to the deal with Oracle. To help pay for additional infrastructure, NVIDIA and OpenAI recently announced a plan that calls for the chipmaker to invest up to $100 billion into the AI company, an arrangement that some have said essentially recycles money that the startup spends in its chips. The company's backers are betting OpenAI will take a leading role in the technology that stands to transform the economy, freeing up plenty of cash for AI products. Analysts estimate trillions of dollars of spending on AI products could be required annually to justify Silicon Valley's investment spree if it continues, fanning concerns that the AI infrastructure frenzy is mirroring the build-out of fiber during the dot-com bubble. OpenAI's chief executive Sam Altman is currently on a trip to Asia aimed at securing the chips and capital needed for the AI startup's plans. On Wednesday, the company signed letters of intent with Samsung and SK Hynix, bringing on the two South Korean companies as memory chip partners to the Stargate infrastructure project. As part of the agreements, subsidiaries of Samsung and SK Hynix are set to co-develop AI data centers with OpenAI in South Korea. That includes a floating type built on water that can address land scarcity, reduce cooling costs, and lower carbon emissions, Samsung said. South Korea traded shares of Samsung and SK Hynix closed 3.5% and 9.9% higher, respectively, on Thursday. Meanwhile, Altman on Thursday visited Japan, where OpenAI formed a partnership with Hitachi. Under the agreement, the Japanese conglomerate will support OpenAI in developing AI infrastructure, including providing power and transmission and distribution equipment to the startup's data centers. OpenAI, meanwhile, will provide its models and other technologies to Hitachi. You have been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 3rd issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Dasha. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have a reading of the Buffalo Criterion, followed at 8 o'clock by the New York Times, and at 9 o'clock by Buffalo Spree. Stay with us for these readings and more throughout the day. Thank you. following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision,